Bill and Dana Hensley are profiled in the bulletin today, and they have on a red carnation so that they can be easily identified. Will you please give them one more warm welcome after church today as new members at UCC? Last Sunday, we thought together for a few minutes about a single word, the word saint, and you seemed to be responsive, so I was encouraged to talk about language again today, specifically about how our religious vocabulary may be confusing. Does it make any difference? Well, in one of G.K. Chesterton's books, two men are talking one day, and when they have a mild disagreement, one of them says pleasantly, "Well, we won't quarrel about a word." At which the other man, who clearly represents the author, flares up. "Why on earth not? Why shouldn't we quarrel about a word? What is the good of words if they aren't important enough to quarrel over? Why do we choose one word more than another if there isn't any difference between them? If you call a woman a chimpanzee instead of an angel, wouldn't there be a quarrel about a word? If you're not going to argue about words, what are you going to argue about? Are you going to convey your meaning to me by moving your ears? The church and the heresies always used to fight about words, because they're the only things worth fighting about." Well, no one ever used words more carefully than Chesterton, so you can understand his passion about them. But the hero of the book of Job agrees with him about the importance of language. "How forceful," he says, "are honest words." The implication is that not all words are honest, and the fact is that they are not, even when people have no conscious intent to deceive. We do some harm simply because we let ourselves become sloppy and careless about the words we use and the ways we use them. If our choice of words is careless, it means our thinking is not very precise, and since much of our conduct comes from how we think, then our conduct gets careless too. If it's true that as a man thinks in his heart, so is he, as the Bible claims, then it's equally true that as a person speaks, so does that person define herself. Not usually in heavy, obvious ways, but in lots of small ways that can add up to a clear revelation of how we think, what we really are. I can illustrate what this means with a very familiar expression that shows how we can be fuzzy about what the church is. It's a warm, clear Sunday morning, and someone says, "Are you playing golf today?" And you respond, "Well, maybe around noon, but I'm going to church first." Now, your friend understands what that means, that you're going to a building where others of like habit will sing and read scriptures and hear a sermon, which it is hoped will be short if tea time is at 12 sharp. You're doing what is called going to church. Now, I would never bother to crusade to change that expression, but I think we should remember occasionally that in a very real sense, we cannot go to church. Because we are the church. If we say it over and over without ever thinking about it, that expression obscures a very important idea, that wherever we are, the church is. When Paul wrote to the church at Corinth, his letter did not go to a building located at the corner of First and Main. It went to believers scattered all over that city who were the church, whether they were at work or at home or at the theater. And the letter was read for convenience's sake when they were all together on Sunday morning for worship. And that word leads us into a moment of reflection about our misuse of still another expression. Sometimes, instead of saying, "We are going to church," as if it were something one went to instead of something one is, we say that we plan to attend the worship service. And that's an odd combination of words. Let's start with the last one. It doesn't take a very keen eye to see that not much service goes on in this building on a Sunday morning. A few professionals and a few volunteers perform a service while the rest of us watch and listen. Not bad things to be doing, but not service. I hadn't planned to say it again, but the Quaker quote from last Sunday is too perfect for this moment to pass by. The Quakers like to say, when the worship ends, the service begins. A church service is not what happens on Sunday morning. It's what happens when people who are the church go somewhere and serve. Paint a house, fix a faucet, drive somebody to the hospital. And worship is not something we can attend. Worship attends us. Every day, every hour. It's an attitude. It's the bowing down of our spirits in reverence and wonder before God's presence everywhere. I grew up in a church that had made a list of what it called the acts of worship, by which it meant things like singing, or praying, or taking communion. But a finite list is a monumentally silly thing, because if you walk through life with reverence and wonder, how many acts will not be worship? I include eating, visiting with friends, washing the car, reading a book. If you have the mind of Christ, which is what you seek more of at a gathering like this, then every one of these simple acts becomes part of your worship, of your total homage to God as creation and purpose in this world. Now back for a moment to the word service. If you record the language people use when they talk about joining the church, a surprising amount of that language revolves around what they hope to get rather than what they hope to give. The question, implicit or explicit, is not usually, how can I serve, But how will I be served? What does this church have to offer me and my children? Now, those are not wrong questions. It's just that sometimes they seem to be the only questions. I've actually had people say to me, I'll join the church if you won't ask me to do anything. Well, sometimes that only means I don't want to sing in the choir or serve on a board. But sometimes it really does mean that church is thought of as a spectator sport. That I've wondered at times if there might not be an analogy between church and a pro football game. On the field, a handful of players who struggle up and down across the white lines until their uniforms are sweaty and caked with dirt, if the field isn't artificial, and sometimes even a little bloody if the game is close. Up in the stands, outnumbering the players about 3,000 to 1, are the spectators who make remarks about how well or how poorly the players perform and whether the coach should be fired for not winning more games, all part of the fun of watching. But what if the announcer were suddenly touched with madness and invited everybody, to come down and take part in the game? I think you can imagine how many people would pour out onto the field. These are spectators, not participants. They bought a ticket. They have a right to boo or applaud. But try seriously to get them on the field. Tell them they have to play or leave, and they'll take their blankets and thermos bottles and head for home. And they're right, because they're acting in accord with the logic of pro football. No one in her right mind would come out of the stands and get into that. But our logic about church is just as wrong as our logic about pro football is right. We were never intended to be only spectators at a weekly performance and to suppose that this is what it means to be the church. The logic of Christianity is that having been the church all week, wherever we were, and having worshiped God all week, in whatever we did, we assemble on Sundays to inspire one another for the next week of work and worship. And we enjoy it. We actually enjoy it. Because the challenge of swimming upstream against the current is so exhilarating. We're not just aimless people standing around wondering what to do next. We have enlisted in a crusade against cruelties and injustice and deception, a crusade where the wars are fought on weekdays, on the street, in our own hearts, everywhere, so that coming to be with the rest of the church is like R&R for a soldier. A chance to regroup, to heal the wounds, and share the small victories, something nobody wants to miss. I sometimes, because I see many of you there, think about the difference in the way we go to basketball games and the way we go to church. I'm using the expression that I have just deplored and will go on using it, as will you. But I think about the eagerness, the anticipation, the excitement that people show on their faces as they arrive at the game. I think about the bitterly cold weather through which we trudge to get there. And then just for a fleeting second, because anything more than that would undo me permanently, I think about how easy it is to miss church if it's damp or cool or you haven't had enough sleep. So if I feel like a martyr and therefore a little pleased with myself when I give up my Sunday of hunting or fishing or golf for the sacrifice of going to church, I'm not a bad person. I'm just a million light years removed from the passion and excitement of those who first made up the church. The last thing in the world that would have occurred to those people was that it might be a sacrifice to meet with their fellow crusaders on the Lord's Day. They hadn't developed enough to pay a musician or a pulpit minister to perform for them. But if they had, it would have been only because they needed, as we do, an hour of inspiration, a recharging of our batteries before we go out to be the church for the next 6 days. We were described once, we who are the church, as leaven or yeast. And the point of that comparison was that we are supposed to be some kind of saving force. What we do happens when we touch the lump of dough we are supposed to leaven. When we make contact and go actively to work on that shapeless mass. The lump of dough is wherever we work or play. We fulfill our mission as leaven somewhere else primarily, not in this room. It would be a pretty silly thing to get a whole room full of yeast cakes together to enjoy one another's company and suppose that this is what Christ had in mind to be our job. To change the figure, as he did himself, we are intended to be the salt of the earth, to keep things from rotting, to keep greed from running amok as it did in this decade, to keep the peace, to preserve the beauty of the earth, to sting a little when we land on the open sore of some ugly or selfish thing. But to do it, we have to get out of the shaker, which is how I would describe this building. And to be poured out as salt, where the preservation and the flavoring is needed. To think that we were simply meant to come here once a week into this lovely white salt shaker and be grains of clean, nice salt touching other grains of nice, clean salt is to misunderstand totally what Jesus had in mind. An alien could be excused for thinking that the church exists to save the church. That for 1 hour each week, we give praise to an idea, and for the rest of that day and all the other days, we forget that there is a difference between us and our beloved friends who make no claim to be the church. We are the world's salt, always in the minority, always essential. And if we are not, then there is no rebuke likely to the world of shoddy repairs and deliberate lies and ugly racism and justice that is for sale to the highest bidder. That world needs saving salt applied to it. And Christianity is what happens when the salt is shaken out. The church is what we are, not what we go to. I'm not crazy enough to think I'm really going to change the way you speak. So go ahead and talk about going to church like everybody else. But in the back of your mind, please say to yourself once in a while, I am the church. Wherever I go, whatever I do, the church is present. And I need to keep that in mind. It will make some difference.